Hi, I'm Ray West here, and I'm talking to Jan Lamprecht in South Africa. And what is your background? Just give an account of your online, your websites.
Okay, I'm Jan Lamprecht. My main website is historyreviewed.com, and my other one is africancrisis.info.
Right, History Reviewed has no, the two words will run together.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Now, what we're going to talk about here is the entire Second World War, and including the run-up, of course, with the First World War. And my view, which I came to, which I'm not certain about, but is I'm fairly sure about, is that we have to take a view of the Second World War as with Jews as a separate belligerent power. Now, a lot of people don't understand this or are not interested in this, or can't, because it's unfamiliar. It's pretty obvious that Germany is a group over there, and Russia is there, and the USA is there. But a separate belligerent group, which is in effect, separate capital cities spread about and keeping a secret, keeping a low profile, is not what they think in terms of. And I have to make this point very, very at some length, really. There's a mistake to think in terms of, for example, German interests or British interests or Russian interests or what Stalin did or what Hitler did. The point is, in each of these countries, you have two separate interest groups, one of which keeps secret, that you've got the Jews doing their stuff and also interacting, and you have the other people. So whenever anyone talks to you about German interests or British or what the Soviets did or something, if they don't mention the Jews, you know they're incomplete and inaccurate and will get nowhere, basically. And the evidence, we have to look at the evidence. How do we know? How can anyone know, be sure, that Jews have a sort of power spreading around the place? Because, of course, it's easily ascribed as a conspiracy theory. This is, of course, what Jews would do. But the evidence is, so to speak, top down. You look at what happened and you conclude that Jews did this. How they did it is another very important question. The questions include just the technology. How did they manage to get information across and so on? So the technology is very important, but so also is the interaction with local elites or local groups. For example, the British aristocracy has been intermarrying with Jews for so long, it's virtually a Jewish, half-Jewish outfit. The same with other groups, particularly business groups, things like oil and shipping and so on. You have to separate out Jewish interests from the native interests. And it's once you get the hang of it, it's very simple. I mean, for example, if you look at the Opium Wars, it's obvious that all the sort of muscle was provided by these simple naval people from Britain and France, but the beneficiaries were Jews. Jews made the money out of it. And now, to adopt this view carefully, we have to look at all the separate incidents and try to integrate them together. And I'll give you an example. Let's look at Britain. Now, Britain, of course, it's well known Britain was bombed. This was in response to Churchill bombing Germany. And the way this is presented is that, you know, Churchill is an aggressor against Germany, and that's the way it's presented in Germany, because in Britain Churchill is presented as a heroic figure with a cigar and stuff. But the point is that Britain was bombed, but it wasn't bombed much. I mean, compared with what happened in Germany or Japan, for that matter, and even France, the amount of bombing in Britain was like a flea bite. I mean, it was hardly anything, but it was enough to enrage the locals and also to allow, for propaganda purposes, all the things like the BBC, and which of course was Jewish controlled. The Jews ran the BBC, as I've put evidence on my site here. That was the point. Britain, I don't think they wanted Britain bombed much, because they wanted, after the war, they wanted to take all the assets, but they had to be controlled pro tem by the British. So what you had was a certain amount of bombing, enough to make these, you know, the simple soldiers and the simple sailors, the simple airmen and the simple low-grade politicians to be anti-German. And not say, they could have said, well, this is obviously an important issue. We don't want to have more and more bloodshed. Let's negotiate again. Let's get somebody competent to negotiate. But of course, they don't do that. All the Jewish controlled stuff goes for war, because they wanted war. And at this point, we have to discuss the Jewish motives for wanting war. And as a separate belligerent power, they've got a completely different attitude from the other countries. And it's presumably based on their Talmudic stuff. They want to kill people, kill whites preferably. And if they can get whites to fight each other, and if they can also make money by selling them weapons, you know, that's what they want. They have a double whammy. And by 1940, it's after the so-called Battle of Britain, which essentially was just a feint, just a thing set up to do, as I say, to enrage people, but not think carefully about anything else. By 1940, Britain was bankrupt. I forget the evidence. There was certainly a letter from Churchill to Roosevelt saying, I presume he meant bankrupt in the sort of cash asset sense. But of course, if you've got a bankrupt empire, you've got bits that you can sort of pick over and buy up. So before the start of the main war, 1940, Britain was bankrupt. And that's a highly important issue, really. They went for war, basically at Jewish instigation. I don't think most Britons wanted war. They remembered the First World War. And most Germans didn't want war. And I'm sure most Russians didn't want war either. So the situation, we have to look at it from a completely new point of view, or at least new to non-Jews, which is looking at Jews in America. And most people by now know that Roosevelt was surrounded by Jews. And Stalin in the USSR, and of course they were all Jews. And German. Now the issue here is, what about Jews in Germany? And the conspiracy theory about Hitler is that he himself, who was set up, he was kind of tested. They had a sort of beauty contest. Could he talk? Could he be convincing? Could he get... Because it's rather... If you look at him, he's not a very appealing character. He's got this kind of mustachioed chap. But at any rate, he won the sort of debate. And then presumably... I mean, he was definitely financed by Jews. Jews, you know, fed him money. Although it may not... Whether that's significant or not is hard to know. You need to know the full picture, and the full picture is not revealed. So from that point of view, Hitler did various things. He spoke, he enraged the Germans, which was quite an easy thing to do. All they had to do was point to the bombing from Churchill and the actions of Jews in Russia. And there's some interesting points which, when you change your focus, you notice things which you might not have noticed before. For instance, let me give you an example. The autobahns in Germany, that's always regarded as being a progressive economic scheme which worked wonders for Germany. But if you think about it, autobahns assist invasions. If Germany is going to be invaded, then autobahns are just the way to do it, aren't they? And it's also worth pointing out that Germany was not united until about, I think it was 1880s, something like that. It was within living memory of a lot of Germans. And again, you've got autobahns, you can get to the bits where there's reluctance to become part of Germany. So that's an interesting, that's a change of focus there. And in fact, I'd suggest also that the Maginot Line in France was deliberately made useless by Jews in France, because obviously you could get around it, and you could also invade from the sea. So it wouldn't surprise me if there's influence in that sense as well. Look at other things. There's stuff about the type of military equipment that Hitler provided. For example, there's a David Irving comment on this, that the Air Force that Hitler constructed or helped construct didn't have long distance bombing. You know, they couldn't bomb. It was difficult for them to bomb England. But also, what they don't say is it's also difficult to bomb Moscow. If they wanted to invade Moscow and get rid of the Jews there, that was a difficult thing too. So arguably, the restricted range of bombing was set up to keep them away from the USSR. There's another thing, of course, about the Versailles Treaty. I've put some of this on my website. It's called, the file name is How Master Race 1, WW2, World War II. I missed out the to keep it shorter. And there's a lot about stuff about Versailles. I quoted H.G. Wells, actually, because he's basically obviously an honest bloke, but he didn't understand about the Jewish issue. I would say, looking at Versailles, it was deliberately, borders were deliberately set so that local Jew colonies in places like Hungary, Poland and Bulgaria and so on, had their own little domain. If you look at things like Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, all these things, do you see what I mean? They're set up to give a local slice to the Jew colonists locally. Poland, of course, is a good example. And now we've got to look also at Jewish policies. And again, how do we know they're Jews? Well, it's you can see what's going on. You've got a Jewish-controlled country, and they're causing starvation. You infer things from what actually happens. I mean, the Ukraine is obviously a perfect example. The USSR had a problem with fertile, hot climates where they could grow things. And the Ukraine is the furthest south area, right next to the Black Sea, very notorious as a grain-producing area. But in my view, it's been slightly misled. I think the Jews in Russia wanted starvation. They wanted to kill people off if they were seen as not useful. And if you remember, there was a scientist in the USSR, the so-called scientist Lysenko. He had some sort of control over wheat production. He kind of ruined it by ridiculous experiments. And the view is, you know, the tradition is, well, you know, this is a sort of silly thing you get with dictators. But it's perfectly possible that Lysenko's aim was to help starve Russians throughout the whole Russian Empire. And that, of course, not having a decent food, not having wheat is a good way of doing it. In fact, I would suggest that there's a possibility that blacks destroying farms in Africa were deliberately put up to it. And I've read accounts of little mounds of the graves of dead blacks in babies in Rhodesia, and possibly Jews, is what Jews do. They regard starvation as a control mechanism. If you remember, there's Malthus in Britain. Malthus set up a kind of scare about population outgrowing resources, but he was assuming that because you're not going around killing people, but if you're a Jew, you just starve them, and that's gets rid of the problem. I think that's the reason. I got on that line of thought because Malthus was ridiculed by a historian, Hobsbawm, in one of his lying books on the 20th century. And he thought very little of Malthus. And I think that's the reason. It's because if you're controlling people, you just starve them. What else would I do? Another thing is Madagascar. Madagascar was suggested as a place for Jews to emigrate. And that actually makes more sense than I'd realized at the time, because Jews tend to like islands. I mean, England must have been selected, I think, because it had lots of ports all around it, you know, ports of entry. There's Bristol and Liverpool and London and what have you, these Scottish ones. And they liked that. They also, as a result of reading Miles Mathis, I realized that the island of Anglesey was important. So Anglesey is off the west coast of England, and that's had quite a significant impact, which I hadn't realized before. So I think if Africa had been developed and parasitized on, then Madagascar would have been a good choice because it's offshore, and they could have exploited all these other countries. So there's let me just make another point, which is kind of a bit marginal here, but Nietzsche is often, you know, kind of promoted. Nietzsche, wonderful person, full of stuff about hero worship, but I think that's bullshit, actually. I was late 19th century Carlyle talked about heroes and hero worshipping in the earlier half of the 19th century. So there's definitely a movement to promote heroes, but I think it's a deliberately misleading. I mean, if you ask, get Jews, who gets a Rothschild or any of these people, a Warburg or something, they don't sort of put on scarlet uniforms with brass buttons and epaulettes and things and mount a prancing white charger, do they? They don't do that. They keep in the background all the time. They use puppets. So I think anybody, if you're thinking in terms of this Nietzschean stuff, you might well be leading yourself to a problem, because you'll be having stuff which you just can't be handled. And it's not the way Jews do things. It's a way of distracting people away from the truth of how Jews operate, which is really just a sort of big mass of, like these killer ants, you know, something like that. None of them are very impressive. It's the mass that gets it done, assuming they're not fought back to. There's also another point, which is on archives of Jewish. If you look at people like David Irving, they look through archives in considerable detail, including things like diaries, but they don't look at Jewish archives, do they? I mean, it's such an obvious point, and yet people omit it. Nobody goes through the archives of banks and so on to see who funded the USSR. I mean, in the 40s, there were $1 billion was given at one point to Stalin by Roosevelt, $1 billion. In those days, you know, worth a lot more than that. Probably it happened loads of times. But that's not, all this kind of stuff is anecdotal. You don't get Jewish archives with showing what was purchased, what weapons were purchased, where they were dumped, all that kind of stuff. And I think that's deliberately manufactured. There was a book a few years ago by Joachim Hoffman called Stalin's War of Extermination, 1941 to 1945, and that was approved of in Germany, so obviously it was Jew-friendly, basically. And that says, that gives a sort of new view of Stalin as having, you know, a much bigger army than they thought. But of course, it's not credible that it was all run by Jews. They must have known what was going on. So that uncertainty represents a change in attitude to Stalin and the USSR. They're trying to pretend something which may or may not be true. You just don't know. But they do have the information themselves, but they're not telling you. Okay. Am I making sense so far?
You're mentioning lots of things that I wanted to reply to, and then you're moving on to the next point.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm just reading from a sort of mini script here.
Okay. Can I dive into some of the earlier things you mentioned?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. I'm seeing your angle of attack. You're looking at things from a different perspective. This is almost like when I wrote my book Hollow Planets, and I went and I looked at physics and history just from a totally different perspective, and then you find that there are some strange things that suddenly make sense that wouldn't have made sense before. So it is interesting when you put on, say, the Jewish hat, and you look at things from the Jewish angle, and you say to yourself, okay, how would these things make sense when I look at it from a totally different perspective? And I'm with you on some of the stuff you are saying. One of the points that you made that sounded pretty good to me was your one about the Versailles Treaty and Jewish colonies getting some kind of preference, and the Jews actually changing borders to suit Jewish groups. That could be something. I've never studied the Treaty of Versailles, and that does sound like the kind of thing the Jews would do. But there are other things that where I do differ a bit in terms of interpretation, like the Maginot Line. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about in terms of the way that you're coming at things is, I agree with you that the Jews are busy spying everywhere, and they are busy trying to influence things, and they are secretly cooperating with each other, and they have a total disregard for our borders and our cultures, because Jews as a power, as you say, Jews as a belligerent power, do in fact carry out their own activities in their own interests all the time. So I'm with you on that. But I do think that there are limitations to the things the Jews try to do. Because as you said, you know, the Jew isn't the one that gets on the horse or picks up the rifle. So he stays in the background. He comes up, when I look at a lot of what Jews do, Jews come up with bad ideas, malicious ideas, ideas that will work for Jews, and they go and they market those ideas to the non-Jews, and they start twisting and negotiating and getting the minds of those people to accept things that are actually harmful to them but beneficial to the Jew. So so the Jew plays a sort of a political and cultural and economic arm-twisting role. But there are limitations to how far he can go, because the Jew is not the commander of the army. The Jew is not the commander of the tank force. And so there are things that happen that are beyond the control of the Jews. The Jew may use his spies to try and take things that happen, and he may then use it to his advantage, you know, by giving it to an enemy or something. But let's take the Maginot Line, for example. The Maginot Line was a military thinking based on World War One. Because of the because of the trench experiences, the French decided that, well, if you're going to do trenches, you might as well do better trenches. And so you had the Maginot Line with all its sophistication, because they believed that that was how war was going to be fought in the future. And they planned their Maginot Line for an attack from Germany. The reason the Maginot Line did not become a problem in World War II, I did a video about it. I don't know if you saw the video.
Okay. No, I didn't. I haven't.
I did a whole video about it. I called it How Hitler and, I think it was called How Hitler and Two Military Geniuses.
In quotes.
They.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
If you give me a second, let me just look it up on my website, then I'll tell you the exact title of the video. I can even pop you a link. And then you can have a look at it. Just bear with me for a second. My machine's a bit slow. Let's just get there. Okay. Because I did a specific video about that.
Yeah. I wasn't. That was only a footnote, as far as I was concerned. It was a footnote to Autobahns. I mean, do you think they would help in assist invasion?
I see where you're coming. Okay, this is the video. It was a two-part video. The video is called "How Hitler and Two Military Geniuses Defeated Europe's Strongest Army, France, in 40 Days." So this is the first part.
Well, doesn't that show that the Maginot Line may have been a sort of Jewish construction, deliberate, you know, intentionally crap?
No.
In the same way that they all... You don't think so?
No.
Yeah,
it
was overcome in 40 days. That doesn't suggest any great competence, does it? Hey, look, we're getting off onto a sideline here. Let's forget this. What about the Autobahns?
Well,
you see what I mean? Autobahns, they're presented as being a progressive thing.
Can I just answer the Maginot Line briefly? Then you'll see where I'm coming from. See,
okay.
the Maginot Line and the French army was competent. It truly was competent. The French weren't stupid, and they had great tanks, and they had a good setup. The French army was solid. The French army was not an incompetent thing. The way that and the Germans themselves, when Hitler reached the point where he decided that he had to now go on the offensive against France, the general staff merely pulled out the plans from their World War One plans. I can't remember the name of it now, but the Schlieffen plan.
Schlieffen, yes.
Yes. So they brought out the Schlieffen plan because they've war gamed it, they've tested it, they've looked at it, and they reckon that this is the perfect way to attack France. And the hierarchy of the military guys were pushing for that. They said, look, if we're going to fight France, we're going to fight it the way we did in World War One, the Schlieffen Plan. We just modified a bit to include tanks and things, but that is basically the best way to fight the war against France. And what actually transpired was a completely different set of events. It was purely by accident that a guy called von Manstein came up. Von Manstein was a pretty high-ranking commander. Von Manstein came up with the idea of what if we change the plan and we try to attack through the Ardennes forest. And he wondered if they could do a sort of attack that could, I think it was to get to the edge of the Maginot Line and to strike through this, like the center where the French wouldn't expect it, that come round by the edge of the Maginot Line. But remember now, von Manstein's not a high-ranking commander. He's not in the general staff. He has no authority. So von Manstein went, I think, and he spoke to Guderian, who was the guy who'd created the tank forces. And von Manstein said to him, do you think we can get tanks through the Ardennes forest? And he had to go and do some technical thinking, and eventually he said to him, yeah.
Can I stop you there? Look, you're going on to a specialist thing which you've paid attention to. It's not very important as regards the general overview. In my view, the autobahns might have been designed to assist invasion, and the Maginot Line, for whatever reason, was not planned properly. I mean, I don't want to go into enormous details, but that's another. These are both examples of Jews at work, sort of fucking stuff up, and to put it in the same way they did with Hitler's Air Force. I think anyway, at least there's a case that can be made there. I'm sorry about that. I just want to get on. Let me. Do you have any? What else do you say about what I was just saying? I've got a few other little points here, which, for example, on religion. One of the things that Jews did was to. It's absolutely extraordinary. It's really weird that they converted Greek and Roman religions into being based on this ridiculous Jesus character. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable, and it still keeps going to this very day. You get presumably Boer, general South African generals or ex-generals, and they all think Jesus loves them. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. And the King James, the Protestants were started. This was another Jewish thing. I mean, the King James translation came after Cromwell, after the Jews were allowed into England. So the Vulgate, the Latin version of the Bible, was translated into all these local languages, including Dutch. So you've got the Dutch Reformed Church, which migrated basically to South Africa. But the Jews have control of all this religious stuff. It's just amazing, or at least enough control to give them a kind of serious vote in it. You get the Church of England now has some ex German Jew running it. So that's another important part. This whole business of Catholicism, Protestantism, and other things like Quakerism. So that is, and yet none of them discuss the Talmud. It's just incredible how negligent people have been. And
may I say something?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, with regard to Christianity, you raise a lot of interesting issues. The Jewish influence there is definitely the big thing. In fact, there's a video I still want to do about where a Jew actually acknowledged this. A Jew wrote about this in 1928. And he said that, people accuse the Jews of this and people accuse the Jews of that. But he said, you know what? All these different things you accuse us of are small fry. Why don't you look at our real crime? And our real crime is that we got you to worship our heroes. And he goes on about Christianity and about how everything in Christianity basically is there to extol the virtues of the Jews and to glorify the Jews. And in that sense, he makes a very valid point, definitely, that, you know, they've managed to get us to move away from our old religions, and we've moved away from our pagan religions, and now we find ourselves with this Jesus character. And something that I also brought up recently, which got me thrown off some lists, was I brought up the issue with some Afrikaners. I said to them, you know, do you realize that Jesus probably wasn't white? And that freaked them out completely. They, you know, because they not only believed that Jesus was a good guy, but they believed Jesus was actually white. And yet Middle Eastern scholars would and scientists will tell you that Jesus most probably was not a white. And scientists have gone and modeled that, you know.
And yep.
So I agree that Christianity's misled us away from our actual instincts and our actual religions. And it's almost incredible that white Christians look on paganism as evil. And yet that is what we were. We were pagans for tens of thousands of years.
Yeah, absolutely. It is curious, isn't it? I put a bit on my website about it, trying to trace this stuff. Incidentally, Jews apparently also invented Islam. I don't know if you know that. They boast about that. They sucked out all the juice from the Roman Empire, and they thought, well, we must have another lot of thugs to work for us, and so they, in effect, invented Islam. Although it's so difficult to get these things, you know, people are so dishonest in these academics, are so useless that it's hard to know. But anyway, but in both cases, they've got this sort of mosaic connection. They've got a sort of a string attached to it, you know. I think this is the main reason. Yeah, this is the main reason that Jews are not, or profess not to be worried about Muslim, you know, invasion into white countries, because they feel that they've got the control of it, as they did have in when Muslims invaded Spain, you know.
Yes.
The Spanish were, yeah. So that's quite interesting. There are other things about Jews. I've got a note here about shareholdings, for example. The way all this economic system has developed actually includes tithes. I hadn't realized until recently that way back there were no tithes, but that was a Jewish thing. And shareholdings are kind of a parasitic thing too. If you hand out some, you know, African supposed leader with, you know, a whole wadge of shares, they get money, and of course it's irresponsible. All the other shareholders want it to be profitable, so you can easily give them 30% or something, and they'll get an income in perpetuity. I think it's worth looking at the Jewish economic contribution, but of course most people just don't know this; they're not aware of it.
I do think that the Jews mess with the economics big time, big time.
Yeah.
They mess with it to an incredible extent. And I've seen here in Africa that blacks who are communists, I mean, these are commies. And next thing you know is that the Jews make them billionaires, and the money just flows to them, man. It flows like a freaking river, like a river in flood. And the money just pours into these blacks while whites are busy starving almost. And I think there's a lot of Jewish maliciousness and parasitism hidden in economics. I think we're only even scratching the surface of it, because there are things that I've sat and thought about. Like I always used to take an interest in stock markets. I've always taken an interest in capitalism because I thought capitalism was a good thing. And I must tell you, nowadays I'm starting to think there are people you must shoot. And I will tell you that I think that there are games that they play with money that are really bizarre. And one thing, for example, that's been bugging me in recent years is there's this market called derivatives. I don't know if you've dug into derivatives.
Not very much. I did do actuarial exams early in
Okay.
my life. I've got some grasp of financial
Okay. So you
shenanigans.
get derivatives, and the thing that for me is creepy about the derivatives market is that the financial value of the derivatives market is greater than all the capital, than the asset value of everything on the planet. And that to me does not make sense. How do you end up with monies that are worth more than everything on the planet? And it's something like, I'm not sure if it's like 20 times the value of what's on the planet. And I think that these Jews are playing games so that regardless of what happens, they have loads of money that come in from nowhere, more invention of money out of nothing, and they're creating markets that run basically on air, and all these things are things that exist, because you've got shareholdings and shares in a company, but now you have derivatives that are based on companies, and the derivatives maybe have more value than the company's value. So how the hell does this come into being? So they've created all these weird things that suck money in or create money, and you can take that money and bring it into the real world and buy real things with it. But you've got more money than there are things to buy. Do you kind of get what I'm saying? And that to me is very creepy. It's like yet another scam of inventing money out of thin air that you can
Yeah,
use in the
I
real
think
world.
it's just I think it's a deliberate sort of deception by using double counting and various methods. I think in principle it's simple enough. I mean, you have to realize that, I mean, if you look at a billionaire, that sounds like a huge amount. But I mean, if you're in a long London street with houses which sell for $1 million each or something, that's only 1,000. That's just one road in London is could be worth $1 billion. And if you look at a globe, if you look at the entire world, do you see what I mean? You have to try and translate it into common sense. And this is a cool thing that Jews are expert at not doing. They're just sort of bullshitters. So I shouldn't get too excited about this. The trick is to try to reduce it to the basis there. Incidentally, another interesting thing about Jews is they have this long-term thing. You know, if you get rents guaranteed for life, that's obviously worth more than the just one single payment. This is why the things like tithes were invented by Jews. I think the way Christianity spread, I think, was as a kind of partly military thing. They'd go to some new country. I mean, I think the last country to be Christianized in Europe was Lithuania in about 1300. And anyway, they'd send people, and they'd say, you know, you've got to convert to Christianity. And they'd have a certain amount of killing and torture, but also bribery. You know, they'd offer them the equivalent of being a vicar or something, provided they collected tithes from the local area. So it was really a kind of money-making thing disguised
Ah,
as it's something like that. Anyway, you see what I mean?
interesting.
It's
Interesting.
but
Sounds like the kind of activities that a Jew would get up to. When you start
doesn't
saying bribery and corruption, that's an old Jew game.
Yeah, you're right in that. That's absolutely. But the point is, see, since they're international, they can, provided things are stable in most of their sort of empire, most of their domain, then they can concentrate on just one of them. They do one at a time and pick them off. I think this is what happened in Vietnam. They had a huge war run with Kissinger, the Jew, of course, committing war crimes all over the place. I think I'm right in saying that they ended up with the land. Essentially, you know, with people having to pay to live on their own land, it's the same sort of idea as tithes. although the, you know, the military correspondents are so fucking useless, they don't understand any of this stuff. I just got a list here on my site here of types of Jew collaborators. I was trying to list them, and you've got things like Freemasons and Common Purpose and bureaucracies in the EU, bureaucracies in Washington, that kind of thing, Friends of Israel, AIPAC. Lots of MPs are collaborators. They rely on it to get to their positions. Same with politicians in America. The royal family, of course, is collaborating with Jews. And you get religious groups, synagogues, Christians, Quakers, a good example. That was also something noticed by Miles Mathis, and I think Islam too. And
tell me about Quakers.
Quakers. They were started by a chap called Fox in about the time of Cromwell. And he spoke to Fox. Fox was a sort of, never did a day's work in his life. It's probably Fuchs. It's probably a Jewish name. And they had this new set of views, getting rid of, for example, all the visually attractive parts of Christianity. You know, you don't have wonderful cathedral stuff. You just have a few boring people talking to each other. But I think Quakers are somewhat like Freemasons. They have a lot of towns have their friends meeting house, which sounds very friendly. In fact, they're often signposted. You get, if you go to the town centres, you get Freemasons or Quakers signposted. You must look that up actually on Miles Mathis's site. If you look at my site here, the Second World War as Jewish scripted mass murder, there's a footnote there on Miles Mathis, and it gives his. I put a site searcher on just to look at his site, because he hasn't done it himself.
What is Miles Mathis's site?
Oh, it's called mileswmathis.com, no spaces. It's difficult to find. You have to click on the writings. I think it's a thing called writings, and then you also have to pick your way through a lot of PDF files, which are all separate. I think he's one of the most impressive writers, but he's been corralled. He's been noticed, and I wrote a few comments lately, and they're it's really quite funny. He's got a sort of mental bodyguards who say if they don't like a website, they just say it's garbage, irrespective. Of course, they don't understand it. Fucking useless idiots. But anyway, so I don't know if he'll keep going. I think he's been corralled. He'll get sort of choked. But there was a good, there's a good piece by Drew, presumably to get into his good books, on Dreyfus. I don't know if you remember, you can't remember personally the Dreyfus affair, but it was a big affair in about 1900, which went on for years.
The in France. Dreyfus.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. He wrote a good piece, a chap called Joss, but I think the reason he did that was because he was a Jew, and I think he had inside information which he was just spilling. But anyway, be that as it may. There's another list here. There's public. I've got skeptics, you know, the so-called skeptic groups. People like Randy, they're all Jews. They're skeptical of everything except Judaism, really. And you get public intellectuals that are on the BBC, universities, civil servants, statisticians, Holocaust fraudsters, the immigrant forcing groups, people who want to increase debt, you know, because if Jews get paid, pay for money on debt. They don't care if how much waste there is. They prefer it because it means that pro tem for the moment they get more money. You know.
I do agree with you that Jews add huge amounts of inefficiency that I've been observing myself, and they like to even create all kinds of organizations, all kinds of bogus organizations with all kinds of cute sounding names, but actually they're busy with some kind of political, either political or business agenda, or both.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't care how much load they put on the system. Jews do not add efficiency to the system. They add inefficiency to the system, definitely.
Yeah, that's nicely worded. That's good, isn't it? And of course it's building up problems for the future, like inflation in particular.
Absolutely. Huge amounts of wastage. I've sat and thought about it a lot, even just observing things in South Africa. Enormous amounts of wastage. And in South Africa, they've even, you know, they go and they get laws changed to benefit them. They create monopolies and oligopolies for themselves so that nobody else can move into that market. They stop all kinds of things. You know, you hear about capitalism on the one hand. Oh, capitalism, free market, capitalism, free market. That's how the Jews used to market things in South Africa. And then what happens is they say capitalism and free market, but it's no free market, my friend. It's a free market for the Jews. And the moment that the Jews don't like competition, then they go and they work on the politicians and others, and they change the laws and they stop other people from coming in as competition. And these people are not people who are free market. It's a Jewish market, let me tell you.
I think that's right. I think the same thing happened with democracy as well. You know, there were these moves I suppose the 18th and 19th centuries, which were taken over by Marx. And, you know, Marx, there's another very good piece by Miles Mathis on Marx as a psyop, Marx as a sort of Jewish hammer to crush British and other workers, which is quite a good point. He makes a very good case. And, oh God, it's called very sad stuff.
It's interesting You mention this Miles Mathis, because another friend of mine was also pointing me to Miles Mathis, and I was quite surprised when you now also brought him up. So I'm going to be digging around his site a bit, because apparently he's written some good stuff on Jews and some theories he's got.
So, yeah, I think, in my view, he's starting to be corralled and rounded up. I don't think he might well not do as well in the future. But yeah, give him a good look. I use my search engine because it'll give numerous files containing names like Lenin or whatever it may be. I'm sorry, I find all this stuff really depressing and people's kind of uselessness. Do you think we've said enough? We haven't really said much about the actual war. I mean, there are plenty of... Let me return to my overview, which is, I think, okay, Britain, they wanted Britain to fight, but to run out of money, basically, so that they could pick up their assets after the war. They wanted Germany and Russia to destroy each other, and that was the function of Hitler and Stalin, presumably, between them. I think the building up of Germany was partly to make it a bigger... It has to look at a threat. If you look on a map, there's Germany, there's a sort of little tiny thing, smaller than Texas, I think. And the idea that they can take over the world is just kind of ludicrous. So they had to make it, I think that's why they permitted or encouraged or something the business of them invading France and the southeast countries, the countries with Jews in, where they could cooperate, presumably. I think there must have been an awful lot of Jewish collaboration with supposed Nazis who were in fact Jews. But the thing was, you have the US supplying material via, you know, money, notably to Stalin, and of course there was a depression at the time. I mean, they couldn't give a shit about the Americans in the South or whatever it was. So there was depression in Britain, apart from amongst Jews, and all this stuff was flooding into Russia, and part of their motivation there was to kill off whites. You know, they had the gulags, tens of millions of them. I mean, the story still managed to get out despite the secrecy of Jews and their lies. And they also wanted them a war, and they got... But the actual practice of the war shows all kinds of anomalies. Like there were wars in odd places like Kursk, which seemed not worth doing, and Hitler approaching Moscow, but never actually invading it. He gave orders not to invade it. So there's all these kind of oddities going on where it's not just... the British at Dunkirk being sort of allowed off or something. I don't know if they were allowed off or there was some kind of... They weren't imprisoned or anything. They weren't made as prisoners of war. Do you see what I mean? There's a whole lot of anomalies, and that's part of the point.
Hitler did give an order that the army mustn't attack the British at Dunkirk. He did give that order.
That's right. But we're talking, this is a bit localized, this is Western Europe, but in Russia. I mean, when the Nazis got to Ukraine, they were greeted as liberators. They were greeted with great relief. But in fact, they didn't exploit that. The Nazis still didn't cooperate with them. That suggests that there was a deliberate policy of, you know, anti-Ukrainism and so on. There are all these cases. I mean, the Second World War was really started by Poles. Well, not, this is where you have to distinguish between Poles and Jews. Poles, Jews in Poland wanted war, and they, you know, they committed atrocities against Germans. The way it seems to be part of Jew psychology, doesn't it, to have atrocities? If you look at all these wars, with look at Deir Yassin, that kind of thing, and Vietnam. I don't know if you've read. I've put a piece on the Vietnam War on my website. It's based on Bertrand Russell's tribunals. Although he was actually corralled, there were plenty of Jews there, like Chomsky and Jean-Paul Sartre and so on. So you probably think, if you've read mostly African, South African publications by Jews, you probably think the Vietnam War was against communists. You know, communes, because they play this commie line. But I think it was a war. They were trying to get rid of these shits, including, well, it was the start of the French and then the Japanese. They wanted to get rid of them. And American atrocities were far worse than anything that the Japanese did, because America, that's one of the problems with whites, is that, you know, they can get involved with things, but they don't seem to have much kind of common sense of the way they're being dealt with. Do you know what I mean? You see these pictures of, I just saw a video of showing Richard Edmonds, who's a British, he was a teacher, he's in the BNP, and the video shows a speech of him, and there's a background showing all these World War One Britons, you know, sort of drinking and laughing around and stuff, all about probably most of them going to be killed, and they think that's nationalistic. So whites are still a bit stupid. They just don't see that they can be dodged around quite easily. I think that's
I think that whites, there are some other thoughts I have on whites that I have never put in a video yet, but it's something I want to return to, about whites being workers. Whites being workers and soldiers, and whites being a sort of a middle class or a lower class, and the Jews being an upper class. And the Jews see things and are used to positions that the whites are not. And the whites are thinking that their leadership is white and they can trust them. And there's nothing wrong with the whites thinking that, but the whites themselves as a group don't have the management experience, let's call it that, to see all the shenanigans of the Jews. And I think that the Jews have worked hard to destroy our leadership and our upper classes. They've worked to either destroy them or twist them against us. And it may go back even to getting rid of kings and queens, and, you know, all this democracy. And then when democracy comes, then they subvert that as well. So I think Jews have worked hard to destroy our upper structures. And because they've destroyed our upper structures, it's been a secret war. So the upper structures have been either destroyed or co-opted or twisted against us. And then what happens is we aren't aware that we've lost our people at the top. And we just carry on thinking that, you know, it's the same as usual, it's business as usual. And we think that our leaders are things, just they had some fights among each other. Meanwhile, we don't know that this secret group has managed to gain power over our leadership. Like you say, the Jews intermarrying with the royal family and all that. So I think that whites at the lower levels are not aware of the secret Jewish war, and that they've lost the war. And so they go in line with what their leaders tell them, and they aren't aware that their leaders are no longer there, you know. And that is what we are now rediscovering, when we get to a point where things are so ludicrous that we say to ourselves, why are our leaders like replacing our populations? You know, why are non-whites being brought into Europe and America? And people now say, how the hell is this possible? And only then, when the problem is truly bad, do whites realize, good Lord, there's something weird going on here. And it's
Yes, I think that's right. It's a Can I give a biological analogy with some
go for
types
it.
of parasites? There's some types of parasites that go into beehives or ants, ant colonies, and they kill off the queen, and they sort of make the workers just continue working for them. They say so they've got a completely alien caste. I think it's something similar with Jews. They
Yes,
go,
yes.
you
I think you're right onto it. And the Jew does it so secretly that the whites aren't aware of it. And so when you say that the whites this and the whites that, I think that normal whites are not to blame for the problem. It's that we didn't have maybe proper communications between our upper and lower classes, between our leaders and the led, and the Jew has come in and he's defeated that leadership. And we must make sure that when we get a leadership structure, that the leadership structure at the higher levels and the people at the lower levels must be completely in sync with each other, totally honest with each other, and we have to work as a team. And if the leaders are under attack, they have to tell us, listen, there's this going on, that's going on. Because if we don't know about it, we won't do anything about it. And the Jew is a master at you know who said it well was Rockwell, George Lincoln Rockwell. He said that the Jew is capable of anesthetizing us. So as the Jew comes to cause pain, he also anesthetizes us so that we don't feel the pain. And there you go. And that's how the Jew manages to get these things done. And it's slow and it's tedious and it takes decades, if not centuries, and the Jew manages to pull it off.
I've heard a similar analogy with the spider bite. If they want to eat if they want to consume their prey, they inject venom, so the thing is sort of paralyzed. By the way, the Rockwell, there's a piece by Miles Mathis on Rockwell, which on the idea that he was just another phony. Mathis has got quite a good insight into blackwashing and whitewashing and all these kind of things. So he's got quite a low opinion of a lot of these people. Mullins is another one. He's very good at kind of picking these out. He thinks a lot of these people are give out part truths, and then the real truth is kind of kept buried. I'll just mention that because it's quite significant. Let me give you another thing which is totally different but related to the whole Jew issue and also to some extent to the war, which is electricity. As I understand from Arthur Kemp's website, that the electricity system in South Africa is sort of on its last legs. It's got huge debts, and the blacks can't run it. So there's sort of ash everywhere and trash and blackouts all the time, brownouts, whatever. I want to just draw your attention to the possibility there's another fraud in the wings with nuclear power. If you look on my site, we examine this in some detail. It's very likely that nuclear power is just a fake, and that the installations they put in are what are called dump loads, which just absorb spare electricity. It's just a sort of load balancing thing. But if South African electricity is in real shambles, then the nuclear power plant will be expected to produce electricity, and that could well be a new scandal and outrage, because they charge billions for these things. It's just another Jew fraud. I just thought I'd mention that because it's highly relevant to Africa as it is at the moment.
Yeah, our electricity, we have problems with it. Though I must admit, the last couple of months I haven't had any power outages. But it is always a dodgy business because the blacks don't do their jobs properly and there's all kinds of scams going on there. I think most of our electricity is generated from coal, actually.
Yes, that's right. It is worldwide.
But when our systems are overloaded, they went and they tried to build new power plants, but there are enormous corrupt scams going on where blacks are all taking percentages of the costs. And so something that should have cost, let's say, 10 billion rand now costs 60 billion rand because all the blacks are busy taking their bribes and so forth. So the main thing that keeps South Africa alive is actually whites. It's actually whites who in various industries actually save those industries and keep them hobbling along despite the incredible mismanagement that's going on and massive theft. So yeah, the whole thing is a shambles. I don't expect it to get any better, although it's not been too bad the last couple of months. But I myself have spent quite a lot of money on solar power. I've even been putting LED lights into my house recently. It's kind of my experiments are rather messy, but they work. And that's all I care about. It's so that I have power and can move on. But I'll tell you, even if we do have power, what I am expecting is that our electricity costs are rising at such a pace that within about 8 years, the costs will easily double. And it just carries on like that. And there are large numbers of blacks who do not pay electricity. They do not pay, and they do not pay for years, and they even go and hook up illegally to it. You know, the whole thing, this country is such a mess, thanks to the Jews and the liberals and the commies. All rubbish thinking, junk thinking, and it's actually only handfuls of highly technical specialist whites who save the country from enormous collapse.
Yes, I can imagine. What's the water supply like? That's another thing that can go. Water and sewage is another thing, isn't it?
That's another one. Water more than sewage. There are problems with water. There's all kinds of issues. They've not been replacing the pipes. There's lots of leakage. There's all kinds of problems with dams and pumps. And it's all maintenance stuff. The blacks then look around and they decide to cut money from maintenance procedures, and then they spend money on other junk for blacks. And then what happens is years later things start falling apart. So the water, I had a friend who was involved in, he was actually a water inspector, and he said that that was his job, and he passed away about 10 years ago. But he said that if we knew how bad it was and how much water is lost due to pipes already leaking and damage to those pipes, and the blacks just bugger around, you know, they are supposed to get pumps to pump water from dams. Then they don't look after the pumps. Then the pumps die. Then there's no water. These blacks are terrible. They are absolutely dreadful. I know of times when whites have gone to buy pumps. Whites have gone to buy pumps so that they can get pumps going again so that their town can have water. So the whole thing is absolute mayhem. But the whites are getting better and better at handling these situations. And the whites also have figured out ways around things. But the whites, but if it wasn't for the adaptability of whites as well as the specialized knowledge of whites, those two things are the things that are keeping us alive. If the blacks were left to themselves, everything would collapse in a heap much quicker. And also these blacks get lots of money from overseas. Large amounts, big amounts. Many African countries would have collapsed in 5 years if they weren't getting money from Europe and America.
When you're talking about charity or something like that?
I'm talking about like government aid. Government
oh,
aid,
right, okay.
Even food okay. aid. You know, blacks in Zimbabwe, half of Zimbabwe's population would have starved if they didn't get money and food from overseas. For years, Americans and Europeans were physically shipping food to Zimbabwe. And all these things, of course, are not mentioned in the liberal mass media. There's so much that's not mentioned.
Yes, that's
so
right.
much not mentioned.
It's very sad, isn't it?
Everything that whites have said is true. And whites, what I've seen in Africa is the liberals and the Jews go to unbelievable lengths to try and pretend that the blacks are competent and that the blacks are able to run countries. That's been like their biggest magic act, is to fool people that blacks can run countries even for 5 or 10 years, because the reality is actually not so. If you had to leave these blacks to themselves totally, the entire country would fall in a heap within 5 years. Easy.
Okay. Yeah, I believe that. It's very difficult to see if there's any solution. Hey, let me just get back to these. Can I just get back to Churchill's character? It's something that I hadn't realized until recently, that there was a quotation by somebody who was in the cabinet, people in the cabinet with Churchill, and the impression you get from these, you know, shitty actors and Jew liars and so on, is that he was focused and produced accurate arguments. But in fact, he was more like Cromwell. You know, Cromwell would speak at length. He would, he had a strange eloquence. He'd kind of scream and yell and plead and argue with people and insist on things. And apparently Churchill was like that. You know, he'd give prolonged, boring talks and speeches and plead and say, talk about the horrid Nazis and stuff. And he was not anything like is presented normally. He was a really strong, really weird character. And I think that's another characteristic of Jews. They don't argue in a kind of focused, definite way. All they want to do is do their parasitic mind, parasitism.
You know something?
Yeah.
The Jewish arguments aren't really logical. They go after emotion. This is something I picked up from my Jewish pal. And one day he admitted that to me. He actually did eventually, after years, admit that liberalism is emotional, that it's got... that these things have got emotional appeal. So it's not logic that they're interested in. They are interested in emotion because people eventually, when they are desperate, they act on emotion. And the Jew comes with all kinds of very, very terrible lines of thinking, terrible, bad lines of thinking, but they do it on the basis of emotion and not logic. Whereas whites operate on logic, and white arguments are always logical, and this emotional kind of stuff is absolutely dreadful. It is so negative, you know, to go and run a country based on emotion rather than logic. It's pure insanity, and these Jews fiddle with people in that way. And all their arguments, you know, go look at their arguments. Oh, we must go to war with Iraq because they've got weapons of mass destruction. Look at Syria. Yeah. Oh, they're killing babies. They're killing babies. All this bogus nonsense. They just use anything. A Jew will tell any lie in order to get his way. That's all he argues, not for logical reasons. He argues to win. That's all. And he'll just argue for 100 years if need be. He's full of shit, and he's not... This is why whites and Jews cannot coexist, because it's not a logical argument. It's not like a debate between you and me where we're saying, well, you know, what is 1 + 2 equal, you know? And we come to an agreement, 1 + 2 = 3. No, with a Jew, it's not like that. The Jew is arguing to win, and he doesn't care about your society. He's just there to come get his piece of the pie, as much of the pie as he can out of your society. He has no intention of working hard. He has no intention of developing anything. He just wants to get his money so that he can go and do his thing. He's all about manipulation. That's
yeah. You get this
and greed, you know, absolute greed, like you cannot believe.
Have you noticed? Oh, you have. You've noticed this thing about trying to disarm whites in the USA by staging these fake school shootings, and they say, "Well, because they're children being killed."
Yes. Yeah. There you see. Well, I won't say I agree that the shootings are fake, but what I will say is they come with this emotional argument to say, oh, you know, all the kids are getting killed. You got to take away the guns because the children are dying. Exactly. That's exactly what I agree with you. Definitely. And they try to catch people. They try to catch people when people are in an emotional state. So there's the shock of the event. Now people are really everyone's shocked. And now the Jew comes and he says, oh, it's the babies. Now let's take away the guns. And then he tries to grab it there and then. And I hope that the Americans never fall for the Jewish tricks, because if they lose their guns, they're going to be finished. Then they've got big trouble.
Yes, I heard you discuss that with Alfred Schaefer. I think what they should do also is practice in working in groups. I think the British Army works in threes, I'm told. So these guys with their rifles might do well to practice maneuvering together. Yeah. Although I've got no idea how to do that.
I'm all for small teams of whites. I've seen the effectiveness of whites. If whites work in small teams, very effective.
Okay. Another issue here that I've got on my website is about Bletchley.
Bletchley Park.
Which is slowly being unveiled. I put an extract on it of Jews at Bletchley Park, and of course there were a lot of them. And
oh, really?
It was very, yes, there's Jewish personnel at Bletchley Park by Martin Sugarman, and there's a list of them. And of course it's much more permeable. They made it sound as though it was a very strict, policed affair, but in fact they had these people working at Bletchley, and they all went home. It was a big, it's a country house, but not that big. So they'd all go back to, during at night, they'd go back to their digs and, hotels and stuff. And of course that's, that's ideal for Jews, and they can pick up the stuff that they've got during the day and discuss it with each other. So,
with secret stuff, the Jews are there and treason is the game.
Yeah,
definitely.
Well, they don't. I mean, they wouldn't describe it as treason from their point of view. It's a tribal thing.
Absolutely, they don't.
Oh, that's what they say.
They don't give a shit about us. Absolutely.
Oh dear. Hey, look, I've got a suggestion. Perhaps we should stop here and we could do it. We could pick it up some other, later on.
No problem. We haven't
really dealt with the Second World War properly. And it's a huge issue. There's also the business of Japan and China as well, and the USA, because there's a lot of, of course, Japan in 1902 or something, there was a war with Russia, and that was funded by, the Japanese were funded by Jews. And
yes,
there was also
that I heard.
Stuff.
That no, I also yeah. came across.